This episode is brought to you by Thorne, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorne is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorne.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorne. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Navy SEAL veteran and the co-owner of Defense Strategies Group, Zach Ferguson. Now, what I loved about this conversation, as I've had with many, many high-level people before, is you have a man who is viewed as an alpha. He's an MMA fighter. He is an elite war fighter. And yet, in this conversation, you will hear courageous vulnerability. He talks about his own mental health struggles, the addiction that plagued his family, the healing journey that he found within himself with psychedelics that ultimately extended into his family, and now he has become a beacon of hope for others, especially men who believe in this kind of faux stoicism facade that a lot of us were raised on. Now, before we get to this incredibly powerful and important conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Zach Ferguson. Enjoy. Well, Zach, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend, Ryan Parrott. I listened to the interview that he did with you on Frogman Friday, and it was amazing. And since then, obviously, he's made this connection. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks a lot, James. Yeah, thanks a lot, Birdman, for having me on the Badass Podcast. You guys check it out. And James, thanks a lot for having me on Behind the Shield. I'm stoked to share my story with your viewers and hit home with them hard, you know, maybe give something they've never heard before.
Absolutely. Well, where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
Say that one more time, you cut out here.
No problem. Where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
Today, where am I today? Sorry, the last part.
That's okay. Where are we finding you today?
Oh, today. I'm in Orange County, California. I was born and raised here. Family's from Boston, Charlestown, Massachusetts. And most of my family's over there, but my immediate family's is here in Orange County. So it's good to be back home after leaving the military.
Well, let's start at the very beginning of your timeline then. I spent some time in Orange County. I worked for Anaheim Fire and I lived in Huntington Beach for a few years. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did and how many siblings.
So I was born at Kaiser Hospital in Anaheim, California, and family dynamic. My dad had a pretty rough upbringing, like lived in the projects in Boston and like left his house when he was 14. And he met my mom, who's a little bit younger. And then he basically, his whole family's basically dealing with like, you know, oxy addiction, robbing banks, armed robberies. So a lot of them got hemmed up with that stuff. And he wanted to leave that life and, you know, build a new life for his kids. So pretty incredible human being, dad. My mom just took a big leap of faith and jumped over here with him. And then they got married here and then been together since.
When you talk to your dad, I'm sorry, mate. When you talk to your dad about the environment that he grew up with, what was the kind of origin story? Because, you know, as you know, people don't just, you know, wake up one day and decide to be an addict. There's usually, you know, trauma and there's a void that's filled and, you know, escapism and all these other areas. Have you been able to kind of find the kind of root cause of where his family's pain started from?
It's a really good question. I've actually never been asked that before. So the addiction runs in my dad's side of the family, like as far back as I can remember. How it's either like disease wise or the life they live, like in the 80s. I don't know if you see like the movie The Town with Ben Affleck, then robbing banks with ski mask. I mean, that was like my uncle's in a nutshell. And I relate a lot to my dad. I'm like both my parents. My dad, I came from a chaotic, thrilling, in a way, energy, adrenaline seeking life. My mom was like grounded, rooted, like motherly, like super nurturing, very kind. So I like a mixture of both, I think. So in a way, I think that chaos threw me into wanting to achieve more or like get out of my comfort zone like he did moving here. But as far as deeper cause of where it came from, I don't know exactly.
And what about career? What did your mom and dad end up doing?
My mom worked at a medical center. My dad came out here and he was a car salesman for most of his life. He retired probably like 4 years ago. So he's retired now. He's 71 and my mom is 65.
Brilliant. Well, let's talk about your kind of early life then. What were you playing and doing as far as sports and exercise back in, you know, the school ages?
So my dad is, he put me in baseball when I was three. That was my first sport. And then soccer shortly after. I was playing baseball and soccer from when I was three till I was 14. And so I was always active, riding my BMX bike, going outside, just rolling in the mud, like just being boy. A lot of sports. It was like pretty much mandatory to at least try new ones and see what you like and be active. And I had a job at an early age as well. So my first job was 13 years old.
You mentioned about having an existential crisis at 13. What was that turning of the page for you?
Yeah, that was wild. It's funny, I only think about that really when I get asked that question. That's cool to think about. I was literally sitting just at a desk in my old house with the old box computers. And, you know, it was like this higher calling was like, you know, here to do something great. Didn't know what it was, but I just started writing a notes on my computer. And then I saved it and drafted it to my email that I still have. It was like, I'm going to be a UFC champion. Like, this is some crazy shit. Can I cuss on this podcast?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, absolutely.
It's crazy shit. They're like, I want to be like president. I want to be a UFC champion. I want to be like a Spartan gladiator. It was like a ton of stuff. And I actually haven't shared this, but for whatever reason, I envisioned like, I could like see death at an earlier age than normal people would. So I like, and I wasn't afraid of, for whatever reason, though, 40 years old was in my mind. It was like death before 40. And that's not what I wanted or want, but I was okay with like going all gas until I was done in a sick way.
Well, I think it's a lot easier to become president now. So maybe you want to visit that.
I want Trump's got that in the bag.
All right. Well, then, as far as the UFC champion, I know you know you're in the martial arts now. Were you doing martial arts back when you were younger too?
Yeah. So I was always fascinated with warrior culture, Spartans, gladiators, Vikings, just combative men that were the best of their time. So I was trying to find something to equivalent myself, and it was the UFC champion at that point in my mind. So I started training at Rain Training Center, kickboxing, and having amateur MMA fights when I was like 17.
Brilliant. What about career aspirations? At that point, what were you dreaming of becoming?
I wanted to be a UFC world champion. So
that was your focus. Okay.
Yeah. I was working part-time valet and living at home and just training twice a day. And I was fighting so I was 16, 17, fighting like Mark Munoz, Chael Sonnen, a bunch of East TJ Dillashaw, a bunch of UFC fighters when I was 16, 17, just getting my ass handed to me. I just started to forge and create something at a super young age.
And where were you training? Was it in Anaheim or somewhere else?
Range Training Center was in Lake Forest, so not too far. Lake Forest, okay. California, Orange County, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing that area has so many good gyms. I trained at, it was called No Limits, but it was Colin Oyama, and he was training Carla Esparza, and Ian McCall, and Shane Del Rosario, who actually ended up dying from an overdose himself. But some really, really good fighters through that camp too.
Nice. I was actually not there not too long ago training jiu-jitsu.
Oh, really? Yeah. Giva Santana, the arm collector, I think they called him. He was an amazing guy. So humble, but yeah, nice. Phenomenal jiu-jitsu guy.
Absolutely. What belt are you?
When I did that, I did Muay Thai with those guys. I didn't do the jiu-jitsu. And then as a firefighter working shifts, I did jiu-jitsu for a while, but my training was so inconsistent and I was so damn tired. Nothing would even stay in my head, but... So then I got my blue belt almost out of pity, I think, from the jungle in Orlando. And then I've been at a gym now here consistently for about a year and a half. So, but if you don't show up in a gi, you don't get any, you know, stripes. So they keep telling me to put a gi on. So I'm working towards my purple, but I'm not there yet.
Nice. Good stuff. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, then you want to be a UFC champion. You're fighting some of these big names that we recognize. Walk me through, you know, where that journey takes you.
Yep, so I had my first fight when I was 17, I think. I lost in the second round with TKO, and then I won 4, so I was 4-1. So that was from like 17 to 20. And just working valet, training, dealing with some injuries, but just that was my goal vision, like I was going to do it. I was progressing fast. And then, like I said, my family's from Boston, Mass. So growing up in my old house, there's a picture kind of like, not like this one, but my dad, like in our living room, crossing the Boston Marathon, this timestamp photo. And I was like, you know, I walk in the front door and I see it every day. And we're watching TV and the Boston Marathon terrorists blew up kids and fucked everyone up. And basically had like a 180 turn of like, God felt like, or he like was like, you're being a selfish prick. You're being like self-fulfilling, selfish asshole. Go protect your country. And I was like, copy that. So I did a 180 turn and was like, how do I serve my country at the highest level I can? And then I started researching and found out what the SEAL teams were through my best friend's cousin. It was in the teams at the time.
Now, what about as far as the ocean? Anaheim isn't, you know, right next to the ocean, the area. So were you swimming a lot when you were younger, or was that something that you kind of got into when you entered the Navy?
My dad threw me in a pool with no floaties. I think I was like 5 or something. So I could swim in the ocean. I was not a great swimmer. I was like very much average, if not below average.
So what is your recruitment story then? Because I've heard, especially the Navy guys, you know, the fear of being placed anywhere if you don't pass, you know, BUDS
is motivation itself for a lot of people. But so what was your recruitment story? And then, you know, let's get to your Buds experience.
I was either lucky or maybe my intent and purpose was so apparent when I walked in the recruiter's office. I said, I'm here to be Navy SEAL. I don't want to hear another word about anything else. Like, that's it. And he said, okay. And then I started doing training for the PST, the physical standard test. So push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, a run, swim. And I trained for about a year in the ocean and in the pool. My buddy taught me the combat side stroke, got the times within like 12 months or so. And then I got a contract to go to Buds. And before I even went to the recruiter's office, so after the Boston Marathon, I was like still in that like existential crisis mode, even that long later, 7 years later. So I sat in my room in the pitch dark, I would turn the lights off, as sick and like demented as it sounds, and just think about like, what am I actually trying to do here? Why am I doing it? And am I willing to like go to the death to complete the training, which my friend's cousin said, like, you must be willing to die. And at first I was like, I don't know what you're shit talking about. And then I like was like, okay, the training is like that, after researching Hell Week and all that. So 6 months later, after every night, sometimes I would stay up all night long. Eventually my answer was yes. And one more snippet on that was I had another like out-of-body experience. So I'm 20 years old at this point, and almost was like meditating. So I was getting like either hallucinating or just going like super deep internally. And this like dark presence, like almost like wearing a hoodie, was like over my shoulder. Couldn't see him. I didn't turn around, but it was a presence of death. It felt like just blackness and the end. And he said, I'm going to test you, like, what you're saying, you're willing to die, but like, you better fucking mean it, basically. And then I had another meeting with him shortly about a year after that.
How did that factor into when you're now, you know, in Hell Week and all the different crucibles that you have to go through for SEAL selection?
Yeah, it helped me tremendously, because before I even signed Navy papers contract, I had already made it through, or I was going to die. So it was like, there was no thought of going to the ship fleet if I quit. It didn't exist there at all. Not even an ounce, a sliver. So it was like very much peaceful, knowing like I'll be a SEAL or I'm dying, and I'm good with either one, either outcome. So first week of Buds, we were in the pool. Before I get there, the class ahead of me, so I was class 319, Buds class, and 318. So we were in basic orientation, gearing up for first phase. And they had a SEAL candidate, Daniel Del Banco, quit during Hell Week. And then he took an Uber ride to downtown San Diego, took the Marriott elevator to the top floor and jumped off and killed himself. So they had a death in the class ahead of me. And then now I gear up a couple weeks later for first phase. And we're doing an evolution called the Beehive, which you have a charged mask, like scuba mask with water, cami pants, boots, cami top. And they throw everyone in the pool. And the instructors are in the pool and they hive you together like bees, like this. So you get really close. And I had a broken nose from fighting before the Navy. So I couldn't hold the water in my mask. It was just basically drowning me. So I was like, come out to refill it. Instructor see me struggling, gave me a little extra love, and to say the least. And I started like really, really having a hard time. I shit my pants and basically just saw the walls come into black. And then that dark figure came like right as it was closing. And he said, you said you're willing to die. Do you mean it or not? And then I just said, yes, lights out. And then I woke up on the side of the pool deck and drowned. And then slapped me back to life. So that was the first little clip of Buds. Welcome to Buds, I guess.
So that wasn't an immediate failure, though. It was just a check at that point.
Yeah, it was more like we have our eye on you. It was an evolution. Basically, it wasn't a timed one or a pass or fail. It was like, go until you drown or ring the bell. And I chose the route I did. So, you know, I walked inside the pool, started throwing up. And then instructor's like, go ring the bell over there. And I said, fuck no. And he said, okay, we'll get the fuck back in the water. I said, cool, put my mask on, get ready to jump in. And he said, stop. I'll stop. The instructor started yelling. And then I looked to my left on the side of the pool deck, and my teammate James, Derek Lovelace, had drowned. And they were giving him CPR, and he ended up passing away. So we lost a guy in our class. Guy ahead of us, they lost a guy too. So that was my first like hardest thing I did there the first week.
That's always such a, you know, a topic of conversation, and rightly so. But there is a fine line between preparing someone for combat or going into a structure fire or, you know, whatever it is in uniform, having them completely prepared, and then obviously that fine line between them getting hurt or killed. What has been your kind of, you know, philosophy, if anything at all? The first one obviously was something that candidate clearly was carrying into selection, that was the final straw for him to take his own life. But then the second one, you know, trying to get people as close to drowning as possible without passing away, that's a difficult thing to do as well. So has it changed the way you look at things at all?
Great question. I believe that much training, the curriculum was like, it's so perfect as far as like getting the crop of guys that are meant to do the job. And we just go to the red line. Basically, the training brings you to red line and a little past it. That's it. And sometimes guys pass away, and that's just the nature of the game. If nobody died ever, yeah, it sucks guys die, but it's fucking training, and they have to bring you to that point of that. And sometimes once in a while it'll happen, and it's necessary, as sad as it sounds. Like, because if they just shortchange the training, and then you're getting dudes that aren't as hard as they should be, and guys die overseas, or they leave their buddies during, you know, a battle or something. So I think the training's phenomenal, and they shouldn't change anything ever.
Yeah, I think I've seen, you know, in some of the fatalities we've had in the fire service, it wasn't so much the training, it was an unknown vulnerability in the candidate. And it might have just been, you know, dehydration and two monster drinks before, or it might have been a congenital heart issue. But yes, there are times where people are pushed too hard, and that needs to be corrected 100%. But I think, you know, when most people graduate just fine, and occasionally you have one of these extremely sad deaths, it does show that you're right there on that line. It's just, you know, I guess it's down to the medicals and the assessments prior to try and see if anyone's going to be vulnerable before they get to that point.
Absolutely. Like maybe doing a little extra screening. I think they said he might have had like a heart condition. So, you know, God rest his soul, but it's just, he went out like a fucking warrior, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So you go through, you know, selection then. Where do you find yourself assigned initially?
So I go through selection, and then I got orders to SEAL Team 7 after SQT SEAL qualification training. So I made it through BUDS first try, made it to the last attempt on a bunch of evolutions, but I just got it done, you know, through the help of my team and, you know, group of guys that are just fucking animals, and the instructor staff. Got to Team 7. My platoon was still on deployment to Iraq. So they had me go to JTAC, which is Joint Terminal Attack Controller, comm school. And then I went to augment SEAL Team 3 in Iraq in December 2017.
So the question I always ask people, because, you know, obviously the specific nature of what people did and where they were is, you know, is none of our business, in my opinion. But the human side of war, I think, is something that we don't really get to see the civilians. If you look at the news, it's either all the way one way, kill them all, let God sort them out, stacking bodies, or it's all the way the other. They're all baby killers, you know, peace man, all that stuff. In the middle are the men and women that we send overseas wearing our flag on their shoulder, you know, to do whatever is needed to be done. So I always ask people a two-part question. The first part, regardless of the politics that sent you, in this case, you know, to Iraq, or if you want to even tie in somewhere else, was there a point where you witnessed some horrors and you realized there were some horrific people that needed to be taken care of?
Absolutely. I think, I don't think I know, like, there's evil that walks the earth. If we believe in God and good, then there must be an evil, right? So, like, yeah, there are horrific people that deserve to not walk this earth, and they should leave as soon as possible. And if we help them get there, then even better. But I've always had strong faith and was believing what I was doing was right and true. I didn't deviate from my morals or values, and that was what's important to me. I didn't care who was president. Like, it's not my control. My job is to protect the guy to my left and right the best I can. And that's what matters to me. Being a good person, saving people who deserve to be saved, saving people you don't know. And then the rest that deserve to be gone can go.
So the other side of that question that we also don't see, but I've heard so many amazing stories on here, kindness and compassion amid some of these combat zones. So what were some of the things you remember when it comes to that element?
Good question. Yeah. So, you know, seeing like little kids overseas, they're like, well, they're not necessarily evil because they're like 5 years old. Like, they don't know what they're doing. So like maybe giving them like a little MRE, like candy packet, or like, and just seeing like their face light up, like, we're the good guys. And it sucks that like their dad goes and like wears a suicide vest and kills his family or like other people. So just having like the good humanized kind soul, like being shown over there, even in such a, like a hellish part of the earth. I think that was like really cool to see, like from multiple people.
So did you deploy somewhere else after Iraq?
So after Iraq, I came back, went to a couple more schools. I joined my platoon, and then we went to the United Arab Emirates in March 2019. And not a crazy deployment. We did some like hook and climbs on ships, not too like kinetic or nothing like that. But it was good. Just continue to be an asset to my team. Training like a motherfucker. I started dabbling in jiu-jitsu at that time too, and just wanted to like lift weights, fight, learn how to shoot better, be the biggest asset to my platoon that I could. And just giving my all. But that deployment, nothing too crazy. Hook and climbs. Iran was like putting lipid mines on ships, so we did like battle damage assessments and stuff like that. And then that was a 7-month deployment, and then we went back home after that.
Up to this point, I mean, you know, you'd had some interesting, you know, ups and downs as far as the generational element with your family and some of these existential moments that you had yourself. Where were you emotionally? Was this taking you to a good place?
Yeah, another good question. So I like deep rooted questions. It's great. Like the death of James Lovelace or like Daniel DeMonco, my best friend, Justin Pegg, in 2018, ending up killing himself while he went to the East Coast, and I stayed on the West Coast. So I basically just like had a bunch of compartmentalized boxes. I just kept putting stuff in there. Anything like dad's using again, box, or death's box. My own feelings were just, I didn't have any feelings really. It was like kind of sad. It's more or less like just a wall of like my eyes were dead. And I just like, I'll deal with that shit later because I don't have time or energy to deal with it. If I like try to go to therapy and do all this stuff and I'm not training as hard as I can, one of my platoon mates gets killed, that's my fault. So I just buried it in a sand pit for a while, which is not the right thing to do. But maybe at the time, that's maybe the time it was, but I had to deal with that at some point.
Well, you said your dad was using it again. So, you know, he came from Boston. Like you said, he moved you guys down to Southern California. You know, he's raising you. Talk to me about the fight he was having simultaneously between sobriety and addiction.
My first glimpse at his addiction was while I was 15, and I quit the baseball team in high school, and he was my coach all growing up. So he was like using Xanax and like just going on these crazy benders, showing up to my games like high, and cops everywhere, starting fights. And at that time, I was still young, so he just moved to a sober living house, and then that was it. He eventually came back and was fine. And then now it's 2020, so a year after the UAE deployment, and I'm starting to see more of like signs of he's using harder. Because I would come home from San Diego to Orange County on the weekends occasionally when I could, and I would eventually just start to see, or he would stop texting me as much as you know that would. He used to send me like a lot of prayers every morning, and then it started to slow down. And so he was battling with methamphetamine addiction, Xanax abuse, smoking a lot of weed, mixing stuff all together, and it was getting pretty bad during COVID time.
Did it get worse because of COVID, do you think, all the isolation that we were experiencing?
It did. I don't like to blame COVID for it, for anything. It's his choice. But definitely like sped up the process of using, because I would come home and I would say, where's dad at? And his backyard, cleaning the yard. He's in a tree, and we have a big ass tree in our backyard. He's like 30 feet up in the air with no ropes, and he's like 65. I bro, get the fuck out of the tree. Like, I'll go do it. And he fell from 30 feet and snapped his leg, and too stubborn to call an ambulance, like crawled to like his bed, and then eventually my mom got in there. But now he's bedridden with the cast on. Now he's using more. So that's the start of like, it really started to spiral after that.
So bring yourself back into this kind of timeline then. You know, you're compartmentalizing all these traumas yourself. You know, where do you kind of get to a low point?
So I went to sniper school after my second deployment. It was in January 2020, and finished that right before COVID started. And then was just doing jiu-jitsu, getting ready for 2021 Yemen deployment. And I was locked in, ready, because I'm point man now, so I have a big responsibility for my platoon. And I was honored to be asked to do that job. So it's not easy, and it's all responsibility. I wanted to carry that weight. And now it's March 2021. I'm feeling good. And then I come home to see my family before I leave. And my sister was diagnosed with Crohn's disease like in March 2021. So she went from 130 pounds to 80 pounds in like 2 months. And she moved back home with my parents in Orange County. So it was my dad, mom, sister. And my dad was using like so much. It was like, I would see him for up 3-4 days at a time. Like just tweaked out on meth. And I sat them all in in the kitchen. And I told him, I was like, if I have to come back and save you, I'm going to resent you for my entire life. And he said, okay. And I went on deployment a month later. So I went on deployment, and now it's July. So a few months later, and deployment's going good. Yemen's a shithole of a country. It's pretty crazy to see. Doing some like special reconnaissance ops, stuff like that. And it's July. I get a text from my neighbor. And he's like, I found your sister in a pool of blood in the bathtub. And because she has Crohn's disease, so she's bleeding a lot. And I was like, fuck. And then, my dad was high on meth and carried her to the ambulance, which I imagine was like brutal to like see your daughter in that state also being high. And then she texted me asking me to come home early. And I was like, yeah, I think it's bad, but I'm also like, this is also my family overseas too. So I like waited that decision for a while, like a couple weeks, almost a month. And then I eventually made a decision to come home early. My chief let me come back early. And I didn't tell my dad. I just wanted to like see what state of that state he was in with the drugs. So I showed up in the door and he was up for 5 days on a meth bender, talking to shadow people, having like full blown conversations with like someone sitting in the chair with that was non-existent. It was really crazy, like, to see that. Heartbreaking for sure.
When I think about these multiple day benders, and then I think about the sleep deprivation in my community and the forced sleep deprivation in Hell Week, you can just see how it's a vicious circle. Once people are on this, you know, this kind of drug journey, when they're on an amphetamine, now they're staying up, now they're getting more psychosis, now they're taking more drugs to deal with it, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse.
Exactly. Like, you know, very like firemen, I have so much respect for firemen. You know, like working like multiple days, like calls throughout the night. So you're not even getting REM sleep. You're just constantly up, you know, through the sirens. Like, so you guys know exactly what I mean. But he's talking like crazy stuff, like talking about blazing infernos, like fire, just dark. Like the devil was like just taunting him. Really what it was. And so I like, my gut was telling me to get my sister and my mom to a hotel room because my sister was bedridden and she couldn't even walk. And my mom lived upstairs. My sister was living downstairs in my old room. And so I moved into a hotel room and then I told my dad I'm going to come back and back to the house after I check in at San Diego to the team. So I went back down there on like Wednesday or Thursday, came back a day later on Friday, or no, I didn't come back. I was at the Padres game with my best friend, just like trying to decompress still, like process. Cause I did make a decision to get out of the Navy after seeing all that. So I had a few months on my contract and then I got a FaceTime call from my neighbor, which he's never even called me in my life. So it's like, pick up the phone. I was like, fuck. And my house was engulfed in flames. I was so angry at my dad for that. And I didn't know if he was like in the house still while I was burning. So I drove to Orange County and the fire was put out like a few hours later. And, you know, he went to jail for felony arson. And it was like midnight. I was walking through my house. That Boston Marathon picture is gone. The room my sister was staying in was burned. Yeah. Everything was torched, bro. It was bad. Like put someone by gasoline everywhere. So
where do you go from there? I mean, your dad's, you know, incarcerated now. You're the rest of your family's in a hotel room. You're standing in the smoldering, you know, what was your home, not just a building, which is why I always chastise firefighters about taking pictures in front of structure fires, because that's, you know, like you said, it's the little things. It's the Boston Marathon, for, you know, picture. It's all... it's what that building meant to these people. You know, it's so important that we're respectful, you know, around that time as well. So kind of, how do you move forward from that?
So I started doing jiu-jitsu at 10th Planet Orange. 2 days just to like, I was so mad at my dad and he like broke our family apart. I needed to like ground myself and just stayed busy. So jiu-jitsu did that for me. I was training in the morning, would lift weights in the afternoon, do jiu-jitsu again. And I was competing a lot. And I said, fuck my dad. I was like, I'm done with you. And my whole family hated him. Just living in the hotel with my sister and mom, just taking care of him. And I was driving to jiu-jitsu on an open mat on a Sunday, and I see my dad walking homeless outside of the street. After he got out of jail, he was like waiting for his charges and stuff. And I was like, what the fuck happened, man? Because he's like the epitome of like the best dad in the world. Like raised us, taught us all these like, I'm like who I am because of my dad. I'm like, how did we get here? And that was my first like come to Jesus moment, or what you want to call it, to like help him, because everyone disowned him. So I was like, how do I do that? I was just thinking of solutions. He was, I haven't shared this before, but he was homeless, and then he was living inside the burnt house in the garage. I'm like, dude, no human, like, you're going to die from cancer in like a month if you stay in here, type of shit. So I was at jiu-jitsu again in January. The house fire happened in August 2021, so it's 4 or 5 months later. And this guy sits next to me and was like, are you okay? And I've never met this dude ever. I'm like, the fuck is this guy? A fucking wizard or something? And I was like, not really. I'm not really, bro. I'm not really that good. And he started talking to me about psychedelic therapy. He was a Marine vet. And I was like, I've done psilocybin and plant medicine therapy. And he brought up ayahuasca ceremony. And I said, I'm in, dude. I needed healing. Because I wanted to heal myself before I helped my dad. Because I was like, I'm all fucked up. I'm no use to no one. So I geared up for June 2022 ayahuasca ceremony. And
talk to me about the experience. I mean, your community, especially with the Ibogaine down in Mexico. I mean, I've heard so many success stories. And obviously, it's not a magic pill. There involves, the being led through the ceremony, and obviously all the work with what you've unpacked once you come out the other end. But I've heard, the kind of the God molecule, 5-MeO-DMT element, where people really kind of realize, what this is actually about and how we're all connected. I've had some people that have had the opposite, some pretty horrific experiences. So what was your actual personal journey and experience like through ayahuasca?
So it was a 2-day ceremony, Friday, Saturday. Before I went, I was writing intentions down. What am I trying to get out of this experience, this medicine? I didn't want to overclutter my brain and have a list of like 100 things. I feel like it would be too much. So my shaman said just 3 or 4 top, the big ones in your life. My first one was release anger towards my dad and the hatred I felt. And 2 was, try to feel again like a human emotion. Because I just compartmentalized everything, was like dead inside. And then 3 was get closer to my faith in God. So it's Friday night, first night of the ceremony, and I'm sitting in the living room, and there's 10 women on one side, 10 men on the other side, and the shaman's to our left playing music, guiding us through our experience. So I'm just sitting there, my eyes closed, having some pretty crazy visuals. And I felt like a very strong wind gust in the room. I popped my eye open and was looking around. No fan on, no door open. I was like, that's really weird. As soon as my eyes opened, it stopped blowing at me. Closed my eyes like 2 minutes later again. And then I popped like one eye open and just like squinted. And all the women were crying. at the same time in unison. And they were like blowing air at me. They're like, look at this. And I was like, what the fuck? I was looking at all of them. And their eyes are closed. They're not even looking at me. They're just doing this. And I saw like that woman nurture love, like could join in the middle of the room. And they like started to come towards me. And I was like, oh. And it went in my stomach. And I looked down. And my stomach was a burning infernal pit. My dad. And I just watched like the fire build. And it was like all hatred. It was like anger. I was like, I thought I was having a stroke. That's how angry I was at him. And it just built up. I watched it go up my neck. My head fell back. My eyes opened. And flamethrowers flew out of my eyes. It like dissipated all the hatred towards my dad. In like fucking 10 minutes. I was done. And then it was like, I love you. I forgive you. I felt what like love was again. Cause I like didn't feel that for so long, especially from like a woman. I was like, what is this stuff? I almost like didn't know what it was. And I was like overwhelmed by it. And I was healed my first intention in fucking an hour. It's crazy. Incredible. So that was a, that was the first night. Went to bed, had a little breakfast, said a prayer. Night two, I was flying through cosmic space on the second psychedelic experience. It was like the most beautiful color. It was like colors that weren't even like on the rainbow, like in the color chart. It was crazy. And I was flying through like first person point of view through cosmic space. And there was no like words. There was no people. It was like just energy of like everything together. And I said in my head, I was like, where am I right now? And I heard a chuckle, like a little giggle laugh. And I opened my eyes and like no one was laughing at me, obviously. I closed my eyes and I said, what is this place? And he said, and I just looked up and I was like, this glow of like light. I felt like God's presence or like everything, everyone, all love. And he said, this is where you came from. This is where you're going to go to when you die. And my interpretation of that was I went to the heaven's gates and saw the like the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And then I said a prayer for my dad. I just prayed that he reaches out and asks for help because he was still avoiding or not taking ownership of what he did and not wanting the help. And then the ceremony ended. And I went to jiu-jitsu Monday, 2 days later. And he calls me like, I haven't talked to him in months. And he said, he didn't say hi. He's like, I bet everybody can help. So all the intentions are answered. Yeah.
Amazing. Going back to the comment you made, because I think so many people listening can relate to this, you know, they just, everything's almost like gray, you know, you don't, you have emotions, but they're like a dampened version. It's like you turn the knob down to two. When did you remember feeling true love, feeling properly? Like what age were you that you, your last memory before it kind of started going away?
Damn. Never been asked that before. Let me think of that. Like I shut off my emotions before I left the Navy. So this was, and I was 27, 28 during the ayahuasca ceremony. I don't think I felt or received the love that I was being shown till I was like 19 years old or something. A long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was probably for my parents and my family. Yeah.
Well, listening to you at this, you can just see this emotional tug of war between the disappointment and anger from your dad's behavior when he's under the influence and clearly this incredible father that, you know, is who you would love. And this is, I think, a really important part of the whole addiction conversation. It's become so judgmental, you know, addicts, crackhead, bum, you know, all these words that we use, but these are human beings. that were brought up in a certain environment, and you've kind of touched on, you know, how your dad was raised in Boston, and, you know, there's this void and they need this void to be filled with something. And okay, you know, sometimes the right mentors around there and it's filled with positive things and they end up flourishing, but more often than not, it leads them down another path. And I think, you know, seeing that this is a person who is struggling, not, you know, like we said, a crackhead or, you know, whatever you want to, a tweaker, whatever label we want to put on them. It's so kind of palpable in all this conversation we've had so far that you, this is unending love for your father, but these constant blows from his addiction, you know, are pushing you away.
Yeah. Well put. I changed my views on like homeless people and people who are addicted to drugs or are, I want to like help them at least like give them the opportunity to give them perspective. So that's why I do podcasts is like, it's not to tell anyone to do anything. I would never do that, especially psych plant medicine. It's more of like sharing a story to give them perspective on what it did for me and my family. And maybe it'll make them critically think a little bit deeper and be like, oh, maybe this is an avenue I could take to help heal myself or someone I love. It's the only reason I do this. So it was like heartbreaking to see that from him, but I just never quit. Like in the Navy, like I didn't, once I made a decision to help him, I was like, I'm going to take this to the very end. So now he said yes to, he reached out for help and brought ayahuasca to him. Eventually he said yes. And he did in October 22, 6 months after me. Got him through there to like weekly meetings with the weekly lunches with the shaman. Gave him like, this is what it would be like, more or less like, how do I get there? Like the right diet beforehand. And he goes by himself and I see him 2 days after for lunch. And, you know, like me, he had like a veil of like dead eyes for a long time. And his eyes were glowing like he was reborn. It's crazy. And he started like tearing up in front of me, which he's never like cried in front of me, especially in a public setting. I was like, what is happening? And I was like, really happy because I could see it. And he said something to me I'll never forget. He's like, besides the birth of my children, this is the best thing as a son you've done for me. And just started like melting, dude. I was like, fuck. Powerful. I was so happy for him.
Amazing. I had a firefighter I was connected with who was struggling so hard, and alcohol was his addiction. But he'd done the work. He'd done, you know, some counseling. He tried ketamine. But I mean, even with the ketamine, they had hooked him up and walked out. They hadn't done the therapy that's supposed to go along with the ketamine that's flowing through your veins. So he, you know, thought he was doing the right things, but was not finding any success. And got him connected with an ayahuasca retreat in Houston with a friend of mine. And, you know, you always, when someone goes off and does something like that, you're always praying that it works, because his comment to me was, if this doesn't work, then that's it. And I've had a friend of mine who was also an alcoholic, and his final rehab, you know, admittance, he said the same thing to me: if this doesn't work, I'm done. And we all know what that means. So from after the other, you know, on the other side, I talked to him, and they said, the first day he's like, James, I thought this was bullshit. Nothing happened. I'm like, what a waste of fucking time. He said the second day I submitted to the medicine. And it's funny because he kind of reiterates what your dad said. He said, including the birth of my children and becoming a firefighter, this was the most powerful experience of my entire life. And it saved his life. You know, and you look at the people that you lost to suicide. And as I sit here in Florida, we just had a suicide in my town with a visiting firefighter who was at a firefighter memorial ceremony, of all things. And then Miami Beach, I understand, just lost one as well. So this is why these stories are so important. This is why I'm so glad that you came on the podcast, and we'll carry on the journey. But, you know, it's not a magic pill, but it's a tool in the toolbox that most people aren't aware of. And that gives them hope. You know, then you start unpacking all the things and doing the work and repairing relationships and everything else that's still left to do. But this is saving lives, and it needs to be at the forefront. It really does.
I totally agree. There's like the stigma of like drugs are bad, or, you know, putting like an illegal label on them. It's like this medicine, like what I always say, like comes from like Mother Earth. How like can you guys put like a label of it's bad? But that's where we come in and share stories and change that persona of like what it actually is, you know? With the suicide, just to backtrack a tiny bit, a couple months before my ceremony, my dad called me and he was done as well. He was like trying to describe like how he was going to kill himself. And I was like, I need to fucking hurry up. He was going to do it. And just if I could drive like 100 miles an hour to him. Just gave him a hug, said I love you. Like, I'm not gonna let that happen. Because everyone abandoned him, so he didn't have no one else, you know. So we ended up getting him off the bridge. And then he gets healed not that long after, so. Incredible.
It's amazing. Well, the other thing as well is that you didn't give up. And I think this is the point, you know, someone will, it might be a fire department, it might be a family member, you know, they go to rehab once and they come out and they relapse and they're like, oh, well, that, you know, it didn't work. And if you listen to most people and their recovery stories, it takes several attempts over and over and over again. And if someone just disowns them or terminates them from a fire department or whatever the thing is, when someone's struggling and they need our help, then you've just cut off all lifelines then. So I understand that some people make it near impossible. And that's why, you know, like you said, treatment facilities and some of these other halfway houses might be a valuable tool. But to just turning your back on them, you're basically signing the death certificate. So if we really love these people, we have to keep being there for them, even if physically they can't because they're a liability, at least, you know, communication wise. And this is what you did. You never gave up on your dad.
Yeah, I bet. Just like love him so much. And he's like such a good human. Like everyone loves him. Like all my friends, he just has like little demons that we all have. And, you know, just a lot lapses of judgment and decision-making, and he just needs some support and, just carry the burden weight for a while. Really heavy, but, I would do it over the same way. Just never giving up. You'd be surprised, you know, for viewers listening, like, you know, James, but like, if you never quit on something, you'll never know how to. So just never quit in my life and keep trucking along.
Well, when people say as well, oh, they make bad decisions, let's go back to where your dad was, you know, 3 or 4 days benders. So completely sleep deprived. His brain isn't working the way a brain is supposed to work. And this is what we talk about with the first responders. After years and years of the shift work, they literally, the brain's reality is distorted. And this is where I always reiterate with the suicide conversation, the old school mentality was, oh, it's selfish, it's cowardly. And you listen to people that have been there. And I've listened to hundreds of people that have been there. You start realizing that they truly believed that they were a burden to the people that they loved. And so if they get rid of themselves, well, all the pain goes away and my family will be okay. It makes no sense to a healthy brain, but at that moment, it's actually courageous and selfless if you think about it. But it's up to us to pull them out of that because that's not the right way to think. But so when you say, oh, you just, you know, pull yourself together, make the right decisions, if your entire reality is distorted, your decision-making is distorted. So it's up to everyone else who isn't struggling to be that baseline, to be that dock that you can moor on while you get yourself, you know, straight again.
Exactly. Dr. Moron, like a pillar of strength for them to lean on. So important because like addicts, they already hate themselves. They already like, they talk bad about themselves. They give themselves down. They think they're a burden. So you can't come out to them and be like, you're an addict. You need help. or necessarily like attack them in that way, or be like, you know, you're causing this disruption in my life. You need to like come at them with like a lot of love. As hard as it is, like, I love you. I'm gonna support you. Like, how can I help you? That's what I found is like the right approach, at least for me. Helping people is just show them love and just be there to talk to them. Just talk to them like even keeled. Don't start yelling at each other. It's not gonna get anywhere. So it's super important.
Yeah. Yeah, I forget who it was now, but someone told me about, you know, the intervention thing, and they even had the TV shows, and I forget the percentage of success, but it was like 10 or something like that percent, because again, you're pouring guilt and shame on someone who's drowning in guilt and shame. It makes no sense.
Yeah, just adding gasoline to the fire, basically. No pun intended. Like, yeah. Yeah, you know, I lost my train of thought right there after it.
I'll reel you back in. So, you know, you go through the ayahuasca, your dad goes through ayahuasca, you see this, you know, incredible gleam in his eyes again. You know, walk me through up to present day with him specifically. Like, how has he been doing? And, you know, what are other tools that he's found that actually improves his healing?
Yeah, so he was healed, I was healed. We started to rebuild our connection or our relationship together. But everyone else, the family, so my sisters, my mom, my brother hate him still. So he started going to, again, his 6 a.m. prayer meetings. He would work out. I'd work out with him, lift weights. And then he would go again at 7 p.m. And he did that, excuse me, every day. And that's like his routine. He needs to do that every day. We need to talk every day, whether it's a few texts, a phone call. We need to communicate. And that's like his baseline of staying on track. He's been sober since ayahuasca. And that was, yeah, October 2022. So over 2 years.
Amazing.
So I kept him on track. You know, we kept each other on track, really. He kept me on track just as much as I did him. And now I'm trying to connect like my mom back to him, my sisters and brother. So the first one was, my sister had my niece, my dad's granddaughter, the day of the house fire. And he had never met her up to this point. This was January 2024. So they didn't talk to him for years. And I was like, Sarah, like, it'd be cool for dad to meet his granddaughter. So she said, only if you're there to mediate it. So we just went to lunch or walked around the park in Long Beach, and they all got along great. Met his niece, and now they talk all the time. Now he babysits her and has a relationship with his daughter and his granddaughter. So that was the first one. My mom hates his guts. Like, she's married to him for 40 years. Can only imagine how mad she was. And I brought up MDMA therapy that they use for, you know, first responders, combat veterans, people with PTSD. And she said no for the longest time, like 2 years. And I'm not like asking her to do it. I'm just giving her like, Mom, I've done it. It's amazing. It helps a lot of people. Here's some research articles on it. Eventually she said yes. And the deciding factor of that was I went up to her apartment and I didn't ask her to do anything. I just started like crying randomly, just saying like, it's like, I'm super sad to see you sad. And that was like the perspective she needed, or that I had at home with her. So she ended up doing MDMA therapy. This amazing therapist that works with a lot of team guys and special operators. And then the therapist asked me to get handwritten letters from everyone in my family, including everyone in Boston. So I got the letters, put in an envelope, and my mom came over to give me a hug before, and I gave her the package, and it had the therapist's name on it. She didn't know what it was. I said, this is a gift for your therapist. She said, okay. And it was all the letters inside. So she goes to the ceremony, and the therapist says, stay up. But I'd been up all night because I didn't want my mom to She bailed on the ceremony two months prior, like last minute. So I just like stayed up and was going to like drive her house if she didn't get here by 9 a.m. And, or if she tried to call me in the middle of the night backing out, I was like, hell no. And then the therapist texted me photos of my mom on this couch, like melting away, like reading a letter from like my dad and one. It was just like, I love you. Like, sorry. It was incredible. I was so happy. So my mom like released all that hatred towards him too. And she's good now. She's like back to her old self. Crazy, bro. It's crazy, crazy. My mom's good. My other sister that had Crohn's disease or has Crohn's disease. She's like such a hardworking, independent woman. I love her so much, but she just wouldn't like, she just compartmentalized like I did with my dad. And I wrote a Father's Day post this year in June. And it had a photo of me, her, and my dad in it. Just like, I love you, Dad. Happy Father's Day type of thing. And she calls me and she's like, take that fucking photo down right now. I look like shit. And we were like 18 years old, 15 or something in the picture.
We all looked like shit back then.
Yeah. And I was like, and immediately my brain was like, that's not what she's actually mad about. And in my mind, I was like, oh, she's still very, very much mad at him and hasn't released any of that anger. So I left the photo up. I said, no. I don't know if it was a dick move, but I felt my gut was telling me leave it up because she needs to like really just like process why she's angry. Mm-hmm. She calls me like 6 hours later and was crying, just saying, I didn't realize how angry I was. And then she, I was like, it'd be cool if you texted him Happy Father's Day. And she did. So she had talked to him for 3 years. And now they're building a relationship again.
Amazing. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Amazing. The MDMA, again, I had done that, you know, recreationally and danced and hugged a lot of people. And, you know, so I saw that it was, you know, I can see the potential of it in this. And I actually plan on doing that particular therapy myself because it's not... there's not a thing, but I feel like that kind of journey, you know, will maybe open some boxes I didn't realize were there. You know what I mean? But so this is the point, though. You know, you've got ayahuasca, you've got ibogaine, you've got MDMA, you've got ketamine. There's all this entire group of other things, and then cambo and, you know, peyote and even more that people just, you know, not even don't know about. They're told not to know about it. It's evil. It's the devil's lettuce. It's, you know, whatever it is, and yet this is the area where I'm seeing so much success. And yes, then it can be combined with talk therapy and EMDR and some of these other things if needed. But, you know, you have, and I've underlined this a lot recently, the FDA denied MDMA-led therapy to be used, you know, to be, I guess, prescribed, you know, used medically. And yet the FDA approved OxyContin, which caused the immense opioid crisis that we have today. So, you know, the more awakening we have on how effective a lot of these treatments are and how, for example, our Navy SEALs, they literally fight for this country. Our firefighters and police and dispatchers and everyone else protects this country. And yet we have to go overseas to get the treatment for what we see and what we have to do. I mean, it's just pure insanity. So listening to not only the person in uniform, but the family around them also being healed by these incredible, you know, plant medicines or therapeutics. Every single guest, every single layer, I hope adds more and more argument and debunks a lot of the fear around these treatments.
Absolutely. And that's getting too political, but it's just a giant money, you know, spin machine giving pills every month, you know, that don't work, that actually make everything way worse rather than going to an ayahuasca ceremony and having a full blown, like I was like healed in a weekend and I don't take any pills to fix me. It was like a one-stop shop, not to say that it was like a magic pill, but it gave me that big 180 turn. And now I have other things I do to keep me on the track. Jiu-jitsu, my family, friends, my girlfriend now. It's like, it's such a big tool, and people are starting to like more and more opening their eyes to like thinking differently or thinking for themselves or listening to people and their stories. The stuff's so powerful. I didn't realize like the reach or the effect it would have till I did like my Gritlands podcast, and the overwhelming amount of messages was like people sharing their life trauma with me that I've never met. And I was like, who have you told this to? And they're like, no one. And I'm like, what? It was like so special, and like, I didn't take it lightly. So I just screenshotted them and I put them in a hidden folder just to look at. And I was like, this is my purpose, is to help people through sharing story. It's powerful, man. So
people use the word resilience. You know, I think a lot of times they think of, you know, assault courses in the military selection, or, you know, the mazes that we do in the fire school, and oh, that's how you become tough and resilient. What I realize is all resilience is working through your struggles, your traumas. And that becomes, you know, a badge of honor. It really does. It becomes, you know, that analogy of the Japanese pottery with the gold glue that they use to be proud of your, you know, your scars. And this, I think, then puts hope into the mental health conversation, the post-traumatic growth. On the other side, over and over and over again, you see that people aren't just a better version of themselves, but they're also a beacon of light for other people. Because they see you emerge out the other end, like, how did you do that? You know, and then that, because you're being vulnerable, because you told your story today, and you're a Navy SEAL, then a lot of people that were kind of believing this men don't cry, you know, rub some dirt in it, suck it up bullshit, go, well, wait a second, Zach was in tears talking about, you know, what he went through. So maybe I'm not a giant pussy. Maybe this is normal what I'm going through, and I can, you know, get whatever my personal toolbox looks like, and be that beacon for other people as well.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it right there. That was like the perfect like caption of what we're talking about, is like, I'm crying on camera in front of random people, and I'm a SEAL, or I was a SEAL. Like, I don't care. Like, the ego is gone already. It's been, it died a long time ago. And like, I'm human. I'm very much average. Like, to make it through SEAL training, I was not a track star. I was not a superhuman, just a regular person with, like our phrase, the uncommon desire to succeed, a common man with the uncommon desire to succeed, and just never quitting. Don't quit on yourself. Don't quit on your loved ones. There's always an answer, and don't be afraid to be vulnerable and ask for help. Lean on people. Don't feel like you're a burden. And, you know, if you never quit, you'll literally never know how to. And that's like my life story in a nutshell.
Well, let me ask you this too, because I think one of the other ways of framing this for the kind of naysayers that are still kind of buying into the stigma is the performance side. I had a guest on, and he was a former professional baseball player, and we were talking about flow state, Logan Gelbridge. And he said, you know, to get into a flow state, you need three things. You need the 10,000, you know, reps of training or hours of training. You know, you need stress, which again, most of us in first responders or military, we have a version of both of those. But he said, and then you need a calm mind. So to be the best operator, to be the best firefighter, paramedic, you need to address that maelstrom in your mind. You need to calm it so that you can get in that flow state. You can critically think, you can make life and death decisions when you need to. So what have you seen as far as your performance after this, you know, ayahuasca and beyond?
Yeah, so I'm very much an introvert, like shy. I don't mind sitting in a room full of people and not saying anything. Not that I'm a weirdo, but just shy by nature. It's helped me like even more so, even after SEAL training, like harness like all human emotions and be able to think even keeled, not see red at all. And that's why like when I compete in jiu-jitsu and like my friends or family watch me, and they're like, almost just like you're like sleeping, or like you're just like chilling in a chair. And like my mind is so calm just because I've been through so much human emotion that I'm able to like, I find myself feeling these, and I could just be like toned down, toned down, tone up this, and just keep them all level. And that helps you just be stable and not make bad decisions through anger or anything like that. So, and that's transcribed into all my life. Like, I'm learning that with my relationship. We're talking to my dad, like patience and me asking for help, like everything all in one. It's super important.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, the ability to receive love from a woman too. How has that shifted now? Because I think this is something that plagues a lot of, you know, first responders. We become this kind of, you know, armored version of ourselves, and we lose the ability to love or feel loved.
Great question. I wasn't able to receive love for a long time, and I've been in a relationship for 6 months now, and it's like that first time, like, someone's showing me love, and I'm like, fine, I'll take it. Before, I was like, no. It's just like denying it was not true, or just being like, I'm not worthy of it. Am I deserving of it? And now I'm like, after Birdman, like Ryan's podcast, and I'm like, I do deserve it. Like, I will take it, and I'll give it back I'll give back as much as possible. And that's been the biggest thing this year, is like receiving love, and my life's way better for it. It was hard to do. It took a long time, but it's important. You have to love yourself as well. Like, don't kick yourself down. Love yourself.
Absolutely. Well, Ryan's one of the people that says I love you to me and vice versa. And I love this kind of movement. Again, men are telling each other that they love each other. You know, I mean, I went around the world with Ryan on that 7X adventure, and, you know, just see what an incredible human being he is. Like, I do love that guy, you know. So I think the ability to obviously deeply love a partner, but also, you know, whether it's your team, whether it's your crew in a fire engine, whether it's just the people in your community, I think that we've had that shut down so much, you know, and it's, you know, all this kind of ridiculous two-dimensional rhetoric on what men are supposed to do, which is absolute bollocks because it's based on actors in Hollywood normally, to refine the love of everyone, you know, especially, you know, men being able to love other men. I mean, we were literally willing to die for each other. If there's no greater love than that, I don't know what is, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I tell random people, like, I love you all the time now. It's like, never pass up an opportunity to say that. Just tell it to your family and randomly text it to them, call them. Like, they need to, like, it might change someone's life, especially telling it to, like, a random person, especially, like, male to male. Like, that's so, like, it's not what we used to do. So, like, I said that to someone and they were like, started crying and then opened up about stuff that they're dealing with. Like, maybe they just needed to hear that from someone, especially from another guy. It's like, it's such a easy but not easy thing to do, but people need to do it.
Yeah. Same as a simple hug. It's amazing how you hug some people and they hug you strongly and you realize that they really needed that hug at that moment.
Exactly. Yeah, that's well put. Exactly.
All right. Well, then moving to what you're doing today, then talk to me about the weapons training that you're doing and what the company offers.
So Michael Dad was on SEAL Team 7. He actually put me through third phase in Buds, and he started his company Defense Strategies Group in 2020. And basically we teach firearm self-defense to, you know, moms, dads, firearm safety courses for kids, just teach people how to defend themselves and their family and their home. And it's been incredible. I joined in DSG through Angel Cortez, who is an Army Ranger. He has this company called the OG Pumpkin. He was a gangster. Yeah, and he, you know, got out of that life and joined the Army. Now he gets back to his community, and I met him at a jiu-jitsu open mat he threw for veterans. And, you know, I just chatted up with him, and he asked me to, if I wanted to be a guest instructor at the pistol shooting course, because it was Angel and Mike. And I said, sure. And then they invited me a few more times, and then eventually asked me to join. And so I've been with them for almost 2 years. It's been incredible. Just now, like, the purpose, my purpose is back, and the brotherhood I lost when I left the Navy is reconnected, and I've never been happier. Like, all those guys in my life, for that. And we just opened a gym called Training Center LA, MMA combatives gym. So now we teach like jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, self-defense classes. That was 3 months ago. So now we're full steam, just trying to give back our knowledge, share our stories, and build a community of people that are looking for purpose in a home and learn how to defend themselves.
Beautiful. What about, you mentioned about training kids. What's your philosophy on educating children and getting them familiar with firearms in an environment where, for example, America, where they just are everywhere at the moment, versus keeping them away and not making them almost scared of them, and God forbid one day they come across one by a mistake?
Exactly. So we're basically showing them, like, you know, if you see a gun, don't touch it, get a parent. But if you, for whatever reason, had to, this is how you clear and safe it. This is how it works. These are the safety rules, like respect the firearm, but don't be scared of it. It's not a toy, just a tool. It's been fun working with them and teaching the kids jiu-jitsu classes, like just building hard men again, hard, strong kids, like, you know, get off your phone and scrap with each other. And like, this is the martial arts way, like be kind to people. Don't be a bully. But if you had to defend yourself or your brother or sister, your family, then you have the tools to do that. And just building strong people again, because we live in a weak society. So we're teaching the course.
Absolutely. Yeah, I said this the other day on an interview. I think it was one of the Gracies that said this, but if every child was taught jiu-jitsu or a martial arts, you know, a lot of the bullying would go away. And it's not that everyone will be tough and be able to fight the bullies. It's the fact that the bullies themselves will be humbled and start learning, you know, the respect and the teamwork and, you know, all the elements that martial arts do bring. And I agree 100%. I mean, you know, as we all know, most bullies are cowards, and they're just trying to make themselves feel better by dragging someone down. Well, the martial arts will lift that person up, you know, because they probably got weak men at home if they're becoming a bully. So the mentors in the martial arts gym maybe would fill that void, and maybe that would even permeate back to the parents and elevate them too.
I totally agree. Bullies are basically people with massive insecurities. There's, like, I say it's a lot, insecurity is loud, and bullies are very loud, insecure, have like trauma that they're just putting on other people to mask their own healing. It just keeps getting passed down by generation to generation. So if you break that mold when they're young, then they won't be able to pass it down, like down the bloodline forever. Eventually just gets stopped in the middle, and then they could rebuild from there.
Absolutely. Well, I want to shift some closing questions so I can be mindful of your time. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
It's going to be a little funny answer. I've asked this once before. I've never read a book start to finish. I failed that, or I almost failed out of high school. I cheated my way through high school. Didn't want to read. The closest book, though, that I read the most is the Bible. And I read like prayers every morning or on my app and at night. I recommend that. And I do a lot of research things, so I find topics that intrigue me. Keeps doing that. And I would say just pick a topic that you're interested in, and then just find a book that is recommended. Like, I can't necessarily give one because I haven't read one start to finish, but for me it was the Bible.
Well, the Bible's a good one. A lot of people love it. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Then what about films and movies? Oh, sorry, films and documentaries, should I say?
It's films. I was warrior culture movies like Gladiator, The Patriot, Saving Private Ryan, shit like that. Like, just I like just like violence, you know, people being skilled in their craft. And I love the way those movies were made. I also really like documentary Free Solo with Alex Honnold, the rock climber. Just like, because I related to him, like he wasn't afraid to die. He was willing to do that to achieve something that's never been done. So I was like, I understand where his mind was at. And I thought they filmed that, and you get to like go inside his brain, which is very interesting. I recommend those for sure.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest takeaways as well is if you actually listen to it, the preparation. He wasn't just like, oh, I'm going to try it, you know, and if I die, I die. It was, you know, years of preparation and making sure that for each section that he was going to be able to do it and then sequentially going to be able to do it. So it reminds me a lot of the base jumpers I've had on. You know, one of them, my friend, he said, a lot of people in whatever it is will say, well, we need to be, you know, 95% effective. He's like, in base jump, you have to be 100. That, you know, 99 means that you ended up splattered on the ground. So, you know, their diligence and their preparation is actually, you know, paramount. And so the application for the military for a firefighter is the same. You know, when your life is at stake or someone else's life is at stake, we should be thinking that way. We should be thinking like Alex Honnold. Now, we're obviously responsible for such a huge set of skills. We can't be experts in every one of them, but we can at least try and elevate as much as we can.
Yeah, basically being a perfectionist, like preparing to where you're so confident in the task you're about to do. Yeah, it's like you said, preparation and the work put in, like his life was that, is that. And he's able to achieve that by just grinding super fucking hard. And yeah, it's incredible. Incredible documentary.
Amazing. There's another one. Oh my goodness. The Alpinist. Have you ever seen that one?
I've heard of it. I have not, but let me write that down.
Yeah, watch it. I can't tell you anything about it. It's one of those ones where you've got to go for the ride. But if you love Free Solo, you'd love that one as well.
Awesome. I'll check it out.
All right. Well, then the next question, is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Yes. One that just came to mind is my good friend, Ian Funk. His Instagram is Grappler with a Sign. He's a Marine veteran and Jiu-Jitsu brown belt, and he's a fireman. Just finished paramedic school, so he's an incredible human being. He has a deep story. Actually, he was also from Boston, was a Golden Glove boxer. Just a great human. I think he'd be incredible. I would love to hear. I don't think he's ever been on one, so I think you guys could relate on a lot of topics, and just a great dude. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah, I'd love to. If you could make that happen and make the connection, that would be amazing. Let's do it.
Absolutely. Awesome.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and DSG, what do you do to decompress?
For me to decompress, jiu-jitsu, competing in jiu-jitsu, it just grounds me. It quiets my mind to basically no thoughts. Now it's hanging out with my girlfriend, whether we go to the shooting range, go to the beach, hang out. I'm a very simple man. The beach, jiu-jitsu, hanging out with friends and family.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, for people that want to learn more about you, want to find DSG, where are the best places online and on social media?
Instagram. My Instagram's at Zach Ferg, ZACKKFERG. You have to type out the full thing because I'm shadowed in. And then Defense Strategies Group. At Defense Strategies Group Instagram, and then at Training Center LA is our MMA gym. If you want to come learn some self-defense classes, come by, stop by anytime.
Beautiful. You said you got shadow banned. I got shut down by Instagram the other day for sharing literally a positivity post. And I have no idea why. I'm sure there's a backstory of, you know, who knows? I mean, it was completely innocent. So I have no idea. Anyway, so I sent you another request. It's Behind the Shield 911 2.0. So okay. You'll be able to find me again. But yeah, looks like okay. We've both been having a shitty time on Instagram, huh?
Yeah, it's crazy. Just want to say thank you, James, for having me on. You know, Behind the Shield podcast, you guys check it out. And then Ryan Birdman, appreciate you connecting us together. I love you. Love both of you. And I'm stoked to share my story. Thank you for having me on and your time and what you do. And being a fireman too, it's like, I love firemen. I have so much respect for you guys. So thank you guys for everything.
Thank you, mate. Love you too.